This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Thank you all for coming to the James Joyce Award ceremony for Muslim Imam. I'm going to just do a little introduction and we'll welcome the mic. So Imam, Dr. Umar Suleiman, is a world-renowned Islamic scholar and activist from the U.S. based out of Dallas, Texas. He is the founder and president of the Yaqeen Institute for Islamic Research, which has educated Muslims across the world and addressed misinformation surrounding Islam and Islamophobia. Yaqeen has published many articles, books, and videos that have reached billions across the world. He's also a resident scholar of the Valley Ranch Islamic Center and member of the Ethics Advisory Board at Southern Methodist University, as well as the founder of Muhassin, an organization dedicated to special needs and an organization in the works of dignity in displacement, focused on advocacy for displaced people. As an activist, Dr. Suleiman has been at the forefront of many issues surrounding refugee causes, advocacy for the homeless and unsheltered, challenging the United States foreign policy and domestic policy surrounding prisoners' rights, and he has been a main force for multi-faith coalition building. He has been recognized as one of the most influential Muslims in the world by Royal Islamic Strategic Study Center and honored by the family of Frederick Douglass as one of the 200 honorees who embody the abolitionist commitment to social change. As a key advocate for the Muslim community, he has especially been at the forefront of the pro-Palestine movement in the US, leading some of the biggest protests on the issue in US history. So please welcome Dr. Umar Suleiman.
Thank you all. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be with you all. I thought about what I would prepare for the evening, and I decided that the best thing that I could do is actually to read the names of Palestinian journalists that have either been killed or are wounded or missing, or even those that continue to shed light on the atrocity, the genocide against their people while experiencing it fully. And so I will be attaching tonight this list of all of the journalists from Palestine that have been killed, as well as some of those who continue to raise their voices. Martez, who has become a brother to us all, Walid Dahdour, who they call the Mountain of Palestine, Hind, Bisan, Saleh Jafarawi, Khalid Nabhan, who has become a father to so many of us, and Nama Jamous, the young journalist who's become our daughter, and then all of those that have been murdered, starting with Shirin Abu Akla to Samir Abu Dakka, and more. And so the only thing that I would like to present tonight is that I intend to attach this to the award, and I hope that all of you remember the true heroes of the day, as all of us are simply standing on their shoulders and seeking to amplify their voice. Thank you.
So I'll start with some questions before we open into the floor. So your parents are from Palestine. What did that mean to you growing up in that environment with that context?
So growing up with Palestinian parents means that you have an intense feeling of belonging at home and an intense feeling of erasure when you're outside of the house. And so while the whole world tells you that Palestine doesn't exist and anything Palestinian doesn't actually exist, you have parents at home that point to a map. You have parents at home that show you symbols of culture and existence, and a beautiful existence at that, that remind you that Palestine is very real, and it's not a figment of our imagination, but instead a cause that drives our daily lives. And so it was an interesting contrast to go outside the home, and I think every Palestinian in the diaspora lived that reality to some extent, maybe not here in Ireland, in most places in the world, where everyone tells you it's not real, and your parents are living that tragedy, an extension of that tragedy, but also an extension of the hope, and you too are an extension of the hope that one day Palestine will be free. So everything from the food to the symbols to the Palestinian maps hanging around the house to the currency of a country that supposedly was never real, to the maps of our lineage, were all around us. My parents were actually both driven out of Palestine, met in Texas. So my parents actually met in Houston, as students at the University of Houston. My father always reminds everyone that he was born well before the State of Israel. And so Palestine was part of our house, and we carried it to everyone outside of our home.
And you mentioned the importance of reminding yourself of the state. How do journalists play a role in that, especially the journalists that you mentioned?
I think that if there's anyone that would have an excuse to not tell the story right now, it would be the people that are the subject of the story. All of these people that are on camera right now have lost loved ones. Some of them had their loved ones taken away from them while they were reporting on the genocide. All of them are living through that devastation. None of them are eating full meals. None of them have full access to the outside world or even to their relatives in Gaza. They're all in fear, but at the same time, they all feel a responsibility to tell the story while they're in the midst of it. The fact that they have continued to persevere and to be the voice of themselves, while many would suffer in silence and feel a great sense of being dejected because the world is not listening to them, they choose to continue to raise their voices and the voices of their people. And they do it with such dignity. They do it with such elegance. They do it with such emotion. And in their very being, just the fact that they stand in front of a camera, despite knowing that that makes them greater targets instead of protecting them. Wearing a press vest is like, you know, wearing a target on your chest at this moment. The fact that they continue to do that is, I think, one of the greatest stories of heroes, living heroes, that we have today. And so if they can do it, if they can continue to raise their voices despite global neglect, then who are we to not raise their voices?
I want to transition into you growing up. I recently saw a podcast where you're talking about your favorite books, and you talked about a period where you're questioning your own faith. What was that experience like? Like, we have some Muslims and some non-Muslims. So what drew you, firstly, to reaffirm your faith in Islam, but even just to discover faith in general?
So I believed in God. I just had to figure out how God was talking to us. There are probably a million people at this moment that believe God speaks to them directly. To me, I had to figure out how God has spoken to humanity throughout history. And so it's testing the integrity of revelation. And so for that, you have to analyze the claim to prophethood that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is making. And if you affirm his prophethood, or if you come to a place where you are satisfied with his claim to prophethood, the beauty of Islam is that then legitimizes all of the prophets that came before him. Because if you believe in Muhammad, peace be upon him, you necessarily believe in the prophethood of Jesus, peace be upon him, and Moses, peace be upon him, and Abraham, peace be upon him, and all of the prophets that came before. Because his claim is inherently tied to their claims. And then it's all coherent because it's tied to one singular message of coming to the worship of one God and then living your life in accordance with that message. Trying to take every element of this world and channel it into a form of worship of that one God. And so I knew God was there. I believed in one God. As a kid, you know, dealing with some of the challenges with my mother being sick and some of the other things I was witnessing, I wrestled with certain issues. But once I came to a place of being satisfied with the claim to prophethood of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, I was fully at ease with my faith and found it to be as beautiful, in fact, even more beautiful than the way it was by my parents. And I think the beauty of Islam is that it establishes the consistency and coherence of the message, that it was a singular message, in fact, to all of the prophets that ever came, one God, and that message never actually changed. Some of the elements of legislation changed. But at the same time, while God spoke to all of those prophets in the same way, we all, not being prophets, have the same access to God, to speak to him. And so supplication is a very intimate experience in Islam. You don't go through clergy.
You don't go through an imam. You don't have to be of a certain level of piety or cross a threshold before you can supplicate and invoke him directly. He is closer to you in your jugular vein. When you call upon him, he responds. And so it's consistent communication that came to us, and then open communication from everybody back to him in that supplication. And so it just establishes a great sense of harmony. And, you know, I'm grateful for the process, because the process allowed me to really find depth in my faith.
And then what drew you to Islamic scholarship and academia? Because I feel like a lot of us in university are get a job, maybe in a corporate firm, somewhere that will pay you the big bucks.
Yeah.
So what drew you to that avenue?
Well, in fairness, my father is a chemistry professor, and he is a really good chemistry professor. He's one of the best in the world. And so I grew up in a house that definitely stressed academia. And my dad did tell me that if you want to study Islam, you've got to study something else as well. So I got a degree in accounting, but I never did taxes. Just to have it here. I really wanted to delve deep into my faith, because reading more affirmed me more in my faith. And so I didn't intend actually to become an imam or to actually take a path where I would be teaching full time, right? I just wanted to delve as deep as possible into the faith. And I think that, you know, there doesn't have to be a dichotomy that everyone has to, you know, abide by here. Pursuing any knowledge that is beneficial is Islamic knowledge, especially if you pursue it with the intention to do great things. There's a saying from one of the four imams, Imam al-Shafi'i, where he said that the two most beneficial groups of people in the world are scholars and doctors. One treats the soul, one treats the body. I know that for a lot of students, it's like you're validating their parents who say you can only become doctors. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that find ways to pursue things that will be beneficial. And most of what we have been taught, most of what is around us, is at the end of the day means for benefit. So it goes back to your intention when you study. It goes back to what you seek from your outlook. Many people simply seek, to earn a living. Instead of just earning a living, try to earn a purpose, live with purpose. And so whatever it is that you're pursuing, make the most out of it. But certainly, I think that, give your faith its due. This is the most important question that will ever be asked of you. And this is the most important question that you will ever ask. Why am I here? And so you have to give it its time. Giving it its time doesn't mean watching a few YouTube videos. Giving it its time means diving deep into that question. Because if you don't know why you're here, then nothing will satisfy.
Growing up, and you mentioned in a lot of your videos, the role models. Who are those role models specifically? And all of us are kind of maybe choosing our role models or have role models, but don't really know why we have them. So what are the importance of it?
I had a lot of role models. I often tell people that your greatest role models are probably your parents, but you just don't appreciate that until you get older. I admired my parents greatly. I don't think I knew how great they were until I became an adult. But certainly in my parents, I had great role models. I think like many people, especially in the 1990s, the movie X came out, Malcolm X, right? The autobiography of Malcolm X was read widely, distributed widely, and then that movie with Denzel Washington, Spike Lee made, went viral before social media, right? Everybody watched Malcolm X, and, you know, he became an icon. And, you know, for me as well, it was interesting because a lot of my world sort of intersected when that happened, because, you know, I went to an all-black school, and so everyone who wasn't Muslim but was black had a Malcolm picture, poster, had like the X chains. And then everyone who was Muslim, black or not black, still had this like obsession with Malcolm X. Like there was this obsession with Malcolm all around me. And I wanted to see him beyond just as a symbol. I wanted to analyze him deeper than that. And what I loved about him was that he had every reason to fail, but found every way to succeed. Like everything was stacked against him. But he turned the darkness of that prison cell into light for the world. I mean, it was incredible to watch his transformation. You know, it's incredible to read the power of his words, to hear him decades later. And what he says seems to be timeless. And one of the things that I admired about Malcolm in particular was that even his foes would say that he was the most sincere of people. Even the FBI was tapping his phones and writing reports on everything that he was doing in their surveillance reports, talked about how saintly he was, right? Which is deeply profound, right? So role models change over time for me. You know, right now I have to say it's Vlad Abednego. There's something about him that just captures so much. I mean, the dignity, the poise in the midst of great pain. He's had almost everyone beloved to him taken away from him. But he manifests such a beautiful steadfastness with everything that he does. So right now I'd say he's definitely a role model. So look for the role models, look for the people around you, look for the people even in your own home at times. People can be role models for different things. As Muslims, the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the Prophets as a whole, and you know, those are the best of people, so we find the connection to them. And one of the ways that God makes them role models to us is that he actually gives us access to their lives in their low points. So whether it's Job or Moses or whoever it may be, you're seeing them in their lowest points, and you're seeing how they rose to be heroes. And so we have a lot of role models that we can look to, both in the past and the present, and hope to be role models for the future.
I remember the first time I saw you was a clip about you talking about Hurricane Katrina. And you've been involved in community support and activism for a while. What have you learned over that time being involved in advocacy? How has it evolved since then?
So Hurricane Katrina is almost 20 years ago now. I remember taking a graduate course, because I'm in Ireland, I have to say this. I took a graduate course at the University of New Orleans comparing Hurricane Katrina to the Irish famine. It's very interesting, the link between the two. It wasn't a natural disaster because there were layers of neglect that preceded it and layers of neglect, governmental neglect, that, you know, unfortunately were forecast upon New Orleans. You know, it speaks to America's constant dilemma of bombing other countries to devastation while it crumbles from within. At that time, you have the George Bush administration, which is arguably the worst in the history of the United States. And people kind of look at me funny when I say that, like, you know, who else has been president? Like, I get it. But that administration obviously started the war in Iraq, started the war in Afghanistan. And while, you know, tearing up these two countries on the basis of the lie of weapons of mass destruction, literally people in New Orleans could not find home, right? Could not find basic relief, could not find basic forms of rescue, right? People were drowning for days without food. The media helicopters showed up before the government showed up. Right? It was craziness. So there are layers of neglect. So you have thousands of people that die at home while you kill hundreds of thousands abroad. You continue to send aid to Israel, which has sustained an occupation and the murder of thousands and thousands of people. It was madness. You know, some people talked about New Orleans and said that Katrina should have been the birth of Black Lives Matter, because there's a heavy racial element to who was chosen to die there, right? And what neighborhoods were allowed to be flooded, and where recovery, you know, was prioritized. All of that was important. So it was an intersection of so many different forms of injustice. It also showed me what it was like to see communities come together in devastation. When you're trying to survive a flood of that magnitude, you're looking at human beings as human beings, right? Everyone came together, communities that never worked together, communities that didn't even know each other, came together to save New Orleans. And so we really connected deeply with other communities. As a Muslim community within New Orleans, and New Orleans traditionally has this welcoming feel, but it was really after Katrina that the city pulled together to rebuild itself. And that was the beauty that I saw in devastation as well. I saw the power of multi-faith coalition. I saw the power of people through great despair to come together to rebuild. And I also, you know, saw hope through it all. I mean, it's interesting. So when the Irish famine happened, New Orleans received, I think, about 40,000 Irish migrants at the time in 1800. It has a history like that. So I kind of took that spirit everywhere I went. The possibility of people building in the midst of ugliness, in the midst of devastation. And we've had to do that quite a few times in Dallas, Texas, and in the country as a whole. And we'll continue to build, but hope for less devastation that forces us to build.
And you mentioned that devastation was forcing a lot of suffering that comes our way. How do you stay empathetic or sympathetic with situations, especially when it be emotionally fatiguing? Even for us, where kind of suffering is delivered to our phones at an instant, how do you not get apathetic to it?
So, when you're an imam or when you're a pastor, or you have to pastor, you always have to be the calm presence in the room, and the calming presence in the room, right? So, you do hospital chaplaincy. When you have to deliver terrible news to someone, or you have to be there when the worst news has just been delivered to them, you always have to maintain voice. There's a risk there that could become numbness, and it could actually become very dangerous. But, you know, I take it as a purposeful, collectiveness in the moment. You know, when we go to refugee camps, when you take youth groups to Syria or to Jordan, people that have been through the worst of the worst do not want you to walk into their tents and cry at their situation. They're looking for a smile. They're looking for reassurance. They're looking for comfort. When people are suffering, they want you to be there with them, but they also want you to be there for them. And to be there for them, sometimes you have to disconnect just a little bit, not to a point of apathy, but to a point of perspective, so that you can help them through the moment. One of the ways that I try to process when I'm in a situation like that is I tell myself that you'll have your chance to cry. My chance to cry will be when I go home, right? My chance to cry will be when I get in the car sometimes, right? It's when I'm out of the situation. But right now, the moment demands otherwise. So being calm, being poised is important by prioritizing the emotions of the person that's in front of you, right? The people that you're there to help in the first place. And then telling yourself, you'll have your moment, you'll have your chance. Now, in general, numbness, which can be just complete detachment, I think that that's found when a person is either consuming too much without recalibrating, or they're not consuming enough, so they're becoming heedless, right? So in the case of a person who's consuming too much of devastation, that's where you take breaks, but your breaks should be purposeful. You garner perspective by reaffirming your own sense of purpose in the world. Comforting yourself by reminding yourself that God is in control. Connecting yourself to God, filling your spiritual fuel, filling that tank, making sure that you're not on empty. And keeping at it, right? So you have to take breaks, but your breaks have to be meaningful. They have to be purposeful. So overconsumption without recalibration is just gonna shut you down. And not consuming it at all is just going to make you heedless, right? And that's where apathy can come. So both apathy and numbness are not going to serve any real purpose. So that's where your private worship, your private devotion has to come in, because that's where you're going to sort of remind yourself very thoughtfully, intentionally, why you're doing what you do.
With activism, of course, the community can get involved in a lot. Ireland, even as a very pro-Palestine country, people have been observing boycotts, protests, such as that. How do people not get fatigued in those situations where they're actually getting involved and trying to make a difference, whether it's on international issues or even climate change or different issues like that?
So I think that sincerity is something that you can only, find deeply within yourself, in your own private moments of worship. But energy and zeal is found with the group. And so how you find that energy and zeal with the group is, you look to people that are continuing to go even when you feel like you need to shut down. You look to other people that are committed to the cause, even if they have more difficult circumstances than you. And in the case of pro-Palestinian activism, look at the people in Palestine themselves. One of the reasons why they have frustrated the settler colonial project is because of their refusal to leave, despite all forms of intimidation and all of the devastation that comes with living under occupation. So if they can persist, we too can persist. If they can continue to report while the bombs are falling on them, we can continue to talk about them while the bombs are not falling on us. If they can continue to strive even after they've lost family members, then surely we can strive while they're still alive. We don't have to look towards, you know, the past or the future for anything to motivate us to keep going. But, you know, the Quran says, tawasal bilhaqqi wa tawasal bis-sabr, right? People that enjoin good and forbid evil together, they work together to do that. Your energy is going to be found with people that don't give up, with people that keep going. And your sincerity is only going to be kindled from within. So the private worship is to kindle sincerity. The public work, the collective work, is to maintain and sustain energy.
And just last thing before I open this area, because I'm sure people have questions. How do we help people at home and abroad? Sometimes we feel helpless or have a limited absent. So even in those situations, how do we help people?
So your goal is to increase capacity to the point that you can be a more capable servant. Compassion fatigue is a real thing. But many people talk about, you know, filling their own hearts and giving themselves more room to breathe so that they can feel better. But we do that as believers so that we can be better. We can be more capable worshipers, more capable servants. We can be more present for people if we take those moments to refill our tanks and we do what's necessary for ourselves. So how we can help people is by being the best version of ourselves and by not disconnecting from them when the world turns away from them and finds something else that's more worthy of its attention. So your boycotts matter. Look, sustained action is what makes the difference. Sustained action, even if it is through collective small efforts, is what allows for even the most brutal of empires to buckle. So keep boycotting, keep protesting. Your prayers matter, your charity matters, your boycotts matter, your protests matter. Be one of those that stays consistent when others have lost interest.
Is there anybody from the crowd with any questions? Don't be shy, this is, yeah.
You talked about giving the study of religion to not plan. What books do you think that did you the most?
So the literature that was available to me back in the late 90s, it's not the same literature that's available to me right now.
Yeah.
There's plenty of well-researched, you know, work out there for you to benefit from. So I recommend, you know, going to the King Institute's website. There are over 250 articles there that are present, a whole body of research that answers some of the most complicated questions about religion. There's a book that's been written called Proofs of Prophethood, which, again, to me, if you prove the prophethood of Muhammad, peace be upon him, and if you test the claim of the Quran, then you're satisfied in that. But you also need to learn about how this all brings things together, right? So who was Jesus, peace be upon him? What were the claims of Christ? How do we find a way to synthesize all of this? Because we believe that these were all divinely inspired people, that these were all people that came with great messages. How do you synthesize all of that? So it's important to go through that research and to benefit from it. A lot of the research that's being produced today takes what has been produced in the past, and we're blessed with that. You know, just talking about Malcolm X, like one of the things that like shocked people, there was no Sira, there was no biography of the Prophet, peace be upon him, in English when Malcolm was in prison. So you had to sort of sparse through, you know, history books or whatever you could find in there to try to put things together. But there wasn't a single book that was written in English about the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, back then. So make use of what's available to you right now in terms of, you know, literature. It's also important, by the way, for like the Palestinian cause. You know, one of the things that frustrates us about you know, what's happening to the Palestinian people and the ongoing atrocities against the Palestinian people is that people just don't take the time to read, right? If you're going to merely consume, you know, a few tweets, a few videos, you're never really going to get to the heart of the conflict. So people need to learn to read deeper into things, read beyond the headline, and make use of all the literature that's out there. There's a ton of it that's out there now, faith and politics. No one ever reads to a point of regret, so just keep reading.
Any other questions?
Yeah, you've spoken briefly by a book, thoughts on the drilling talks about US imperialism and foreign policy. Is there any point or decision that the US have made that has been a benefit to the rest of the world? Would you think that their isolation would be a benefit for everyone? Or is there foreign policy that you can point to that you agree with?
Can I point to, that's a great question, is there anything in US foreign policy that I agree with?
Yes, essentially.
We're not doing much right now that I can agree with. I think that the problem with U.S. foreign policy is that even when it does good, even when the United States government has done good, there is always, you know, a very malicious spring attached to that good. So when Anthony Blinken says, we put more aid into Gaza than anybody else, we've sent more humanitarian aid to Gaza than anybody else, we've also sent more bombs into Gaza than anyone else and funded the occupation more so than anyone else. So I think that's the problem with U.S. foreign policy, is that it's inherently built upon American interests and not the interests of humanity. And in fact, to the detriment of humanity, all for American interests, and not even the interests of the American people, the interests of weapons manufacturers, the interests of deep, you know, PACs and nefarious political interests. It's frustrating. It's really frustrating, you know. And I think that most American people, when they sort of open their eyes to this, they go, whoa. You know, we have basically functioned as a global bully. And even when America takes the right side of history, it does so for the wrong reasons. And so we were on the right side of Bosnia, right? We were on the right side of Afghanistan at some point, right? We were on the right side of fighting colonial powers at times, but only so that we could replace them as a greater colonial power. That's the problem. And so I think we have to not just challenge American imperialism, but challenge the ideas that have propelled colonialism in the 20th century, where we still face the aftermath, unfortunately, now in many parts of the world. You have to, you know, really interrogate the underpinnings of colonial ideology and then talk about how the effects of that colonialism remain today. Because unfortunately, you know, one of the things that Malcolm said about Africa, he said they clip the bird's wings and then blame it for not flying as high as them, right? So unfortunately, in a world where people can't pay attention for more than 5 minutes online, right, how are they going to read, you know, beyond 5 years in the past? You have to read about what has led to the current political situations that we are living in now, and how we can actually restore not just those specific situations, but we can fundamentally shift the way that the world works. And that's only going to come through the power of the people, as, you know, as cliche as that sounds, right? That's where people power comes in. When enough people insist upon a different way of being, that these political interests can't merely compete with one another, all to the detriment of you.
Thank you.
Yeah? I have a question for you. Obviously, in the last certain times that we deliver, they've become increasingly challenging as Muslims and there's xenophobia all around us of wanting for it. How do we deal with that? How do we pursue that?
So the way that we persevere is by first and foremost remembering that others have had greater challenges and they've been able to overcome them. So that's where looking in the past is really helpful, like finding the inspiration from those people in the past. And this is something that the Quran constantly draws upon with the lives of the prophets that came before them. They've been through greater challenges than they got to points where they thought that there was no end in sight. The beauty of faith is that it causes you to manifest the best version of yourself with absolutely no expectations in regards to the outcome. So if the outcome is not what I seek, then I'm content knowing that there's a greater plan. But then I also have to do the best that I possibly can and put forth my greatest effort. So there have been difficult times in the past, and there will continue to be difficult times going forward. But you know, I do think that there's a lot of hope. Look, coming to Ireland, I have to admit, like, being a Palestinian American, like, Ireland has become legendary to the rest of to Palestinians around the world. Like, when I told Palestinians, family and others, I'm going to Ireland, it's like, whoa, like, okay, now make sure you go to this person, go to this person. Are you going to be going to this protest? It's unique here. I'm sure that you face your challenges, but recognize that your challenges are different from what others face. And so you have opportunities amongst those challenges. The fact that you can challenge that bigotry is in and of itself an opportunity for you. So use that. You also have the leverage to be able to speak for populations that can't speak for themselves in the other countries of the world. So use that to your advantage and keep going.
No more questions?
Thank you so much for coming out.
Thank you.
I'd like to present this to you personally. Round of applause, please.